Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have Derek Bell, Le Mans legend, five-time winner of the world's greatest race. Definitely the world's greatest endurance race. Thing I love about Derek, among many things, 26 starts at Le Mans, 19 finishes inside the top 7. Granted, it's in a variety of classes, but if you look at the man's, if you look at the volume of his starts, 26 of them, he survived all of them. When he got to the finish line, which he happened to do at most events, top 7. I mean, that it's just a phenomenal finishing record. You look at everything he did, 10 podiums at that race. Then think about all of the different cars that he drove. That's another thing that is just, it's incredible. Think about his start driving for the Ferrari factory. Beautiful Ferrari 512. Then moving to a Porsche 917 into GTs. A win in a privately constructed car with a Cosworth DFV. Drove for the French Renault factory at Le Mans. Drove for the German Porsche factory. I think Derek's most heavily associated with our friends from Germany. And had a just, boy, you look at what he achieved at that race between 1981 and 1988, and very few drivers on this planet can claim to have had as much success as Mr. Bell at Le Sarthe. We spoke about, frankly, not all the years there, but a lot of them, and he just provided incredible insight, a lot of fun as well, serious character. Not someone who necessarily limits his answers to the ones that are asked. So that was a lot of fun. Spoke about racing with his son, Justin, which is also a pretty cool thing. Spoke a little bit about his desire to drive the reigning Le Mans winning Porsche 919 hybrid. Also gave his thoughts about who might win this year's race. So fairly long call, fairly long conversation, but hopefully one you enjoy with one of the true legends of Le Mans, Derek Bell.
Your career at Le Mans, in and among everything else you've done, this to me is the one constant of driving phenomenal vehicles, of excellence, and all kinds of other buttery, loving things I could say, but I just thought it might be fun to do a bit of a winding walk through Derek Bell's career at Le Mans, starting with our lovely Italian friends and a pretty amazing Swedish co-driver in 1970.
Unbelievable. What? When you think about it like that, it was just amazing. I mean, you know, I say to people, they say, "Well, I'm going to go to Le Mans." You know, young guys. I say, "Yeah, you got to do it." So go in something insignificant, quietly, you know, and just go around and learn it and get used to the atmosphere and what it's all about. And then I suddenly go, what am I talking about? And I was in a freaking Works Ferrari in my first Le Mans, my second sports car race. What am I talking about? Take it easy.
You know, I asked this of Mario Andretti yesterday and also of Dan Gurney. What were your thoughts of the track? I guess maybe just walking in and looking at it visually in 1970 and then also those first laps in that red missile.
Well, all I can say is obviously I never walked it, nor as many, I guess. But I assume I must have gone on the road, you know, in my road car, and sort of driven the bits I could drive on because you couldn't do the whole way around. I don't know. I know you couldn't go the whole way around. They must have shut it off at Porsche Curves, as it was then. But, you know, with trucks and things whistling up and down Mulsanne Strait, you don't get an impression that he's going to do 200 miles an hour the next day, or even that afternoon. And it's something that nowadays, of course, guys get on, you know, onto simulators, and they're doing the fast laps before they even sat in the race car. But it was different in those days. It really was. And then you got in. I mean, then we were saying at an event I was at the other night. I got inducted in the Hall of Fame the other day, by Motorsports magazine.
Beautiful.
Two nights ago, which was with Rossi and Dan Gurney, who was the American driver, and France. What's his name? Sebastian Loeb and Professor Sid Watkins.
Wow.
You know, what a group to be with. It was amazing. I mean, Ron Dennis, you know, presented the award to Sid Watkins' wife, which was very moving. It was the first time I've seen Ron quite sort of quite a gentleman, really. That's fair, Sid.
Well.
But it was fantastic. It was a lovely evening. But while we were there, so I'm not bringing that to sort of brag, obviously, much, apart from that I'm looking at the trophy on my desk, but the whole thing. But it's the fact that we were talking about it then. And, you know, in those days, you just sort of, you know, you didn't drive on tracks. You didn't get the opportunity to go on them before. And, you know, you got in the car for the very first time. I'd never driven a long-tail Ferrari. I'd never driven a long-tail anything at Le Mans. And, you know, like all the stuff that we did in those days, whether it be Formula One or whatever it was, I mean, gosh, I remember, I mean, you just got in it in a day of practice. If, you know, and you didn't get much practice because the number one driver got the bloody practice. So, you know, it was, when you think about it, we hardly knew anything when we went into the races. And, because nowadays, as I say, simulators, they sort of, they're doing lap record times. They never sat in a race car at the track yet. It's quite weird, isn't it? But it is the same for everybody, I suppose. But, of course, some people have better simulators than others, don't they?
So Mario described the track on his first impression as daunting. Dan described the ever-present danger, or at least the immediate awareness that danger could be easily found. Were you struck by similar things or different things once you were at speed?
Yeah, I think in many ways I would suggest I was a lot less experienced than those two. And so for me, it was like Christmas. I mean, I know it was the track. It didn't matter if you've never been to the track. You've never been to the track. But as far as I'm aware, I just remember... The one thing that I always remark on is that when I used to arrive at Le Mans, and this is where it has changed, and I'm so lucky to survive anyway, but so lucky to be part of the era when we had the real Mulgong straight. And I never forget and I've said this in various articles, it's probably in my book somewhere, and not that I expect you to have that, I should let you have one.
I have it, of course.
Oh, you do? But it would be surprised if it wasn't in it, but generally speaking, as I always drove to the race from my home here in the south of England, and I'd drive, you know, up to Le Mans, and on that Monday afternoon, generally, because we had Scrutineer on Tuesday, as you drove up, sort of through that, sort of basically tunnel, with the cathedral on one side and the old historic Le Mans on the other.
Yeah.
You'd go up that narrow road with a very high sort of roof over it, up into the Place de la République. And it's very dark and very sort of somber. And as you drove up there, suddenly, you know, the only place I've been in the world, and I often said, I bet it must feel like the drafts of the drivers that go into Indianapolis driving through the tunnel, because I've done that, but not with the same reason. But, you know, to drive through that tunnel, which everybody has to drive through, basically, and just get that sense of foreboding that you're going to be driving down that Mulsanne straight and into the unknown, because every time you go, you're going to be driving something faster than before. And, nearly always that was the case. Not every time, but 90% of the time, I was driving something that was going to go quicker than the year before. And it was spectacular, a most gutty feeling, sort of, you know, it really gripped you right there and then, I'm back at Le Mans. And there was nowhere else like that in the world, apart from possibly for the early IndyCar drivers, you know.
Yeah.
Used to drive that time. But I knew it was dangerous, and, you know, we all knew race racing was dangerous, but it was just that daunting Mulsanne straight that you never knew what was going to happen, because there were not such things as wind tunnels. We're talking about, there was no computers, so everything was purely sort of rule of thumb, or, you know, sort of just sticking a finger in the air, which is a bit, and lick it and see which way the wind blows, say, okay, it'll work or it won't work. And I guess when you just think that we drove that bloody 917 down there at 246 miles an hour, and it had never been that fast anywhere ever before, you know, what was happening? I mean, it's bloody brilliant when you think what they did, what Norbert Singer and those guys did. But, funny enough, right beside me, I've got a wooden model. I had the first I had the, every year there was a model guy that used to make models for sale for, you know, of all the cars in the race each year. And of course, he very rarely had, you know, the one for that year had started off as a wooden model. And I've got the wooden one. I've got it car number 7, which is the car. I hadn't noticed it for so long. It's just sitting there quietly on my shelf. It's only small, yeah, 4 inches, 5 inches long. But, I mean, that was it. You know, we got in the car and we just went off and drove it. And of course, that Ferrari, bless it, wasn't exactly, you know, it was stable. It just wasn't desperately going over, obviously, 200 miles an hour. But it was just the, it was felt heavy. I suppose it probably was. But I'd never driven anything else. So what the hell was I going to know?
Sure. What was that experience like with Ronnie? I mean, I know at least for what I've seen, and he became a hero of mine the minute I learned about him, but I've never associated Ronnie Peterson with driving lightly, softly, or anything that would lend itself to 24 hours of survival. What was he like in a non-Grand Prix environment, though?
Well, because I knew him already, because we'd done Formula 2 together.
Sure.
And I guess we had. I'm trying to, unless I mix you that with that Formula 2 with him after that. It probably was after. No, it wasn't much after, because he died, didn't he? Not that long after. Because we're talking about 1970, aren't we?
Yeah.
When did he die? Late 70 or late 71, didn't he?
Actually, I think it was a little bit after that, actually. I think that was 78. 78, actually, at Monza.
Oh, was it that far away? Okay. So I wouldn't have driven against him in F2. I did, but that was after we drove together there. I mean, he was in F3, and I guess I had only just really left F3 not that long before. But I was doing Now, it must have been in the Formula 2 when I was in the Formula 3 Dinos and those things, and he was coming through Formula 2. Because I was doing Formula 2 as well as sports car, you know what I mean?
Sure.
I could easily find out, but I know I've got it somewhere, because I look at the record to see, because he would have beaten me, probably. But he was very calm. I mean, he and I were good friends, and he was very calm and cool and relaxed, and he never gave any impression of being nervous. But then, as a driver, you often see a different side of somebody. You know, I found him very relaxed and easy to chat to, easy to work with. You know. It was great.
So I love the fact that you go from glorious 5-liter V12 Ferrari in 1970 on your debut, as if that wasn't iconic enough. Hey, let's come back in 1971 with Joe Siffert in a Porsche 917. Mate, I mean, you've already ticked off two, you know, all-time great vehicles, but obviously we know the history of the 917 and also the fact that, let's just say, it inspired heightened levels of safety in future models. What was that experience like in such an absolute animal of a vehicle, but also, again, an iconic one for sure?
Well, Martin, it's really strange because I if you had said to me, what was the 917 dangerous? I said, what the hell are you talking about? Of course it was. To me, it was bloody brilliant. You've got to realize, all I've driven before was 512S, which was safe and strong, and every Ferrari I drove was safe, whether it be Formula 2, Formula 1 or that. It was always strong and robust. And Porsche didn't have a record of cars breaking and crashing. And I never read about the sports car races. I didn't read about races, maybe only the races that I was in, which sounds awfully, you know, sort of egotistic. But, you know, they're the ones who are trying to read what they said and whether somebody noticed you did that good move or whether they thought you were getting better or not.
Sure.
But, I mean, to be honest, I never knew anything about the 917 being a dangerous car. It dawned on me when I realized that Siffert and Rodriguez would never go testing with me. They were never available to ask it. They would always say, no, I can't come there, I'm off somewhere. And I never got a real answer. And as the season went on, I remember saying, why don't these blokes ever come bloody testing to David York? You know, he said, I don't know. So he said, ask them. So I said, Joe, I said, why do you never come testing? Not bloody likely, so not getting to that thing more than I have to. I thought, thanks a lot. But, that, you know, that was life. But I honestly didn't realize it was a dangerous car, and I stand up for that car because, thank God, I didn't get hurt in it. And actually, not many people did when you think about it. It was only poor old John Wolfe, the only one to cop it.
Yeah.
You know, and he shouldn't have been in it anyway. You might say, well, Lordy, you shouldn't have been in it either, Derek, but I didn't make a mistake. you know, like, I think he made a mistake. Well, as soon as he did, it was going to go wrong. But, I mean, the car didn't break. I mean, they used to pray every time we got out of the car, pray thanks, you know, thanks to God for the fact the car had survived another race. They hadn't broken. But I never saw it break. And if it did, if they did have a problem with the tubes cracking, they never told us. Because they didn't want us to know, so they never got in it. I mean, I wasn't a brave sort of lunatic type person. I didn't rush out and jump off mountains or go climbing mountains and, you know, bloody jump out of helicopters with parachutes on their back. I was the most sort of, you know, very sort of normal person and didn't do anything dangerous. The only thing I did was drive racing cars because I knew I loved driving cars. You know what I mean? It's a very weird thing. But nothing frightened me with a car. I just got and drove. Even now, I mean, I was in a 1,000 horsepower McLaren the other day, and it didn't bother me at all. I mean, I was at Texas, you know, that P1 GTR thing with 1,200 horsepower.
Sure.
I just drove it right out of class. And I thought to myself, God, if I could start racing again, I could start again right now, as long as the car was like this. It was so brilliant to drive. And I realized that not that many people are going to get to drive it, I suppose. But I'm incredible, you know. I noticed it was very smooth. It had a lot of power, but it wasn't ridiculous. It wasn't horrible. You know what I mean? It wasn't as violent as the McLaren, McLaren by chance, but the Can-Am McLaren, which when you touch that big 8-litre, it popped and off, it sort of disappeared up the road. It's just so progressive.
Yeah, you'd some of the older cars, you could almost get a concussion by hitting the throttle too hard and slapping your head
That's
backwards.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the cars, I mean, all right, we're not talking about cars today anyway, but nothing, I wasn't brave. I mean, you know, I used to play rugby for my city, and I didn't dive off the deep end unless I saw somebody else dive in first. And I said, oh, well, it must be all right, I'll dive in there. I mean, follow me, I'll jump off the tree, let's climb to the top branch. So it was just confidence or stupidity or naivety that I didn't realize that it's bloody dangerous. And don't get me wrong, I knew it was dangerous because Jimmy Clark had died in my first big race, really. So I knew all about the dangers, so I wasn't being stupid. But I trusted the car, and I think it never crossed my mind to not trust it. Maybe it'd be the Ferrari and still would today. You know, or even a Porsche. Particularly a Porsche now, because they learned so much from that era, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, fast forwarding a little bit to your time with the Gulf team and 75, it was wonderful to see Marino Franchitti, who readily admits you're his hero. It was wonderful to see him turn up at the Monterey Historics last year in full Derek Bell helmet livery and whatnot and drive the GR8. I don't believe it's the exact chassis you drove to victory, but nonetheless, honoring your first Le Mans win. I love the fact that that car didn't have some specialty endurance racing motor. It was a DFV, obviously tuned for endurance racing. But I love the fact that that car had a little bit of, you know, had some Formula One to it. And it also wasn't a big factory vehicle. It was just a well-thought-out prototype. What was it about the car that worked for you?
Well, it was John Warren, John Horseman, and those guys, to be honest. I mean, they just, and I guess Len Bailey, who designed it, but I didn't think it was that good a car, to be honest, a basic car. It's just that they made it good. And I don't mean to be rude to Len, but it really didn't handle that particularly really well. We made it handle better by just the strict John Wise, sure sitting in doggedness to make sure it worked. The story, I mean, they spoke to Keith that was. John said, we're going to go to Le Mans, Keith, what do you think? And Keith said, I wouldn't go, lad.
Hmm.
Yeah, that. And we did go. I mean, we finished fourth the year before and then, you know, won it the next year. So everybody forgets I finished fourth with Mike Hurley the year before. And, you know, that was without the same engine system, I think. I think it was a more regular engine, but shouldn't have finished. And lo and behold, there we are, you know, going back that year with the bloody Grand Prix engine and winning it, albeit down detuned in certain areas. And it was a boring race to drive in because you couldn't really drive it that fast. I mean, we're fast enough to win, which is really all John Wire wanted to do.
Sure.
But it was lovely. I'm driving it at Goodwood in a James Hunt tribute in a few weeks' time. Because James and I drove at Nürburgring together, I think, Austria, I think. So that, you know, the owner of the Mirage, which again is the Le Mans winning one, he's asked me to drive it because he can't be there. But it was just a great little car, and it was we tested until we were blue in the face. And of course, we were trying to get over that fuel thing, and the whole bloody thing about it was frustrating. If you couldn't drive it like a real race car, I think that Ickx and I had this ability, as John Wire would say, we had good hands. And we had the ability to bring a car that should have won the race to victory. And I felt that maybe with the 936 and the 956, to be honest, the first time. Because we just didn't torment the car. It wasn't that we didn't drive it quickly, because we were always leading. You know what I mean? So we had to be quick.
Sure, sure.
But we just didn't abuse it, I think.
What did winning Le Mans for your first time, what did that mean in 1975? And I know that might sound a bit daft, and it probably is, but I was 5 years old at the time. I began to love Le Mans in my teenage years, but was this something that held the same international acclaim and brought that kind of spotlight to the same degree it does today, or was it... you know, just curious what that win did for you and what kind of attention it brought, good Lord, 40-ish years ago.
Well, I mean, basically it was the biggest thing I'd won, but I mean, remember, I had done a bit of Formula 1 before that. I'd done quite well in Formula 2 and Formula 3, so, step into sports cars is never the way you really wanted to go. But at least, but for me, you know, it saved my life, basically. And made my life because I carried on with it. But we didn't get the publicity. We weren't recognized by the world's press because Le Mans was Le Mans. It's about manufacturers more than people. And I remember, sort of coming home on the boat as we used to on the Monday, and the press was full of it. And we got so much publicity from winning. But remember, we weren't a factory team. So John Wire really wasn't bothered the least bit about the publicity, although I'm sure he convinced Gulf that they should utilize it sort of full PR-wise. I don't know if they did or they didn't. I really can't remember that long ago. There's quite a lot of stuff we did. But, I mean, I remember John brought the car down to the farm here, where about quarter mile from where I am now, and we had a big dinner for various people that we could, like John Wire and Paul Swin and people. I don't know if they came. I can't remember that. You know, the car just sat outside the barn, you know, with Justin, you know, my daughter Melanie, sitting on it.
Oh.
You know, 8 or 11, whatever they were. Or 7 or 8, should I say. But it wasn't publicized the way it would be if it had been a factory Ford or a factory Porsche. And, you know, it's the same stuff, really, when I won with the Porsche. I was in a German car. So I still didn't really get the exposure that I would have done if I'd been in a Jaguar.
Sure.
Eventually, the Brits had to watch because the bloody Brit was winning it a few times in a German car. So eventually, they dropped their English flags and waved an English and German flag at the same time going down into Mortown Corner. But, yeah, I mean, as far as the PR afterwards, the publicity afterwards, it was very little. And I remember thinking, I remember saying to Guy Smith, actually, just recently, I said, don't think the whole world's going to open up for you to go and sort of make a fortune out of it, because you won't. I said, you win them all once, and it's obviously one of the guys that won it once. But you've got to win it two or three more times before people start to take notice. And you've got to have a bloody good PR guy doing it. And I mean, even when you look at the Audi, to be honest, all the races they've won with that car, it's only Audi that wanted the publicity. It didn't want Christensen to get publicity, or Capello, or whoever it was. And it was the same in our day. Le Mans was for manufacturers. It was only when top drivers came in, like Dan Gurney and Chris Amon and whoever came in to try and win it for Ford, that, of course, the driver, because he was well-known, carried as much as mileage as the actual manufacturer's name.
Hmm. That's a great point. So, again, this is just me loving the weaving nature of your Le Mans career. Moving forward just a little bit, You sign with a Renault Sport team, and their little angry teapot. Unfortunately, next to those entries, there are the three dreaded letters of endurance racing, DNF. Tell me about that team. At least for what I've read about it, it was not only French, but I mean absolutely French, Gallic to the core.
I was the only non-Frenchman in the whole team. I mean, mechanics and everything. But remember, I'd won Le Mans 2 years previously, and I hadn't done, I guess, in 76. I can't remember the hell I finished it. So I think I finished it. Anyway.
Fourth.
Oh, well, that's not too shabby, I suppose. But you know, when I got with them, it was like they took me, because I obviously was... And they knew me through Formula 3. You've got to realize that they were European, and I raced against Jabouille and Jusso and... not Pironi, but all those guys. I raced Formula 3 and Formula 2 against them. And, you know, I drove the year in 75, and not only did I win Le Mans, I think I won four races in the Alpha T33.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we were getting a lot against the Renault team. They were the people that were there. The Renault, that's right. Renaults were racing the small car, the smaller sort of 2-litre. And then a 3-litre with basically that Formula 1 engine. And they were so bloody fast. And they had a factory team. And we had this truck that came up from Turin every couple of weeks with a couple of cars on it. German team ran it with the Alpha. And it was really a most dissatisfying year in so many at the time, because I like winning the races from the front, not from winning because the two cars in front of me failed.
Of course.
And time again, we just won. And so Pescarella and I was able to win. There were a lot of cars behind us, nonetheless. But, you know, we wanted to win, and we couldn't win. We couldn't beat them. But they'd fail. But they were learning all the time, and then 2 years later, they called me up and said, would I go and drive for them? So I guess they learned a lot, because they didn't have Pescarella in the car. Do you know what I mean? And he was French.
Sure.
They had a French guy, and Pescarella won it at that point. I think he'd even won it. He'd won it with the Matra, hadn't he?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he'd won it after that. But so if they didn't take it, maybe he had retired from racing in 78 and 79, I don't know. But whatever it was, I was the only one there, and I was very flattered to get to be part of the French team. And they were so well organized. It was so strange, because I'd been at Porsche for a year, which seemed like just the previous year. And then I'd been with John Wyatt for a number of years. And I'd been in Formula One teams in Surtees and whoever else I'd driven with for. And there I was in this little French team that were obviously going places. It was so bloody obvious. And what they were using them all for was a test bed for what they were going to do in Formula One. And, of course, the car was magnificent. And we tested. We used to go testing at Paul Rick. I got so sick of that bloody place in January. And we'd go testing there. And I remember when we went to go to Le Mans, I mean, how was I to know? I'd only done Le Mans. I'd probably done it 6 or 7 times, but I had won it just about once in 75. But I'd driven some really good teams. And I had a good idea, thanks to Wire, John Wire, about what was really, you know, good and what was bad about racing at Le Mans. And I knew it took you 3 years generally to win Le Mans, and it still stayed pretty much that way. It takes you a couple of years, probably takes you 1 year less now, perhaps 2 years because of computers and all the technology that they have at their fingertips to develop a car. But, I mean, we went there that first year, and I remember people coming out and saying to me at the race, you're going to win, and I said, what makes you say that? They said, because the car's so fast. I said, well, that doesn't make it a winning car.
And, is this the 2.4 hours of Le Mans? I think that one we have covered.
Yes, that's right, yes. So, but the first year, I mean, we raced till 8 o'clock in the morning. We did 16 hours, and we were leading. I don't know, 1 year I was leading by 17 laps. Somebody was telling me this weekend. Some bloke that seemed to know all the bullshit. I mean, can you believe leading by 16, 17 laps? Bloody long way, isn't it? Yeah, that's basically, I mean, how far is that? Anyway, it doesn't work. Not worth thinking about. 150 miles or something, but whatever. It doesn't really matter, or which year it was, but I knew 1 year. And wherever we tested, that car never completed the test. We never had 100% 24-hour test. And I had learned although I didn't quite hear it, it must have been with wire, because there wasn't really anybody else apart from the 917, and we never did 24-hour tests for that. First time I drove it was, I think, at Le Mans, and the test weekend. And so, you know, I guess the people say, oh, you're going to win. And I say, we're not. And they say, why? And I say, because we haven't finished 24 hours yet. What makes you think that just running around test tracks and Paul Ricard, that you're suddenly going to go and win Le Mans? You're not. If you can't go bloody 24 hours around Paul Ricard, you're not going to win at Le Mans with that massive straight. And, of course, we didn't. And I wasn't trying to prove I was right. I mean, I tried to win as well as anybody, but
of course,
it just doesn't work that way. So the next, so later on that same year, we did 24-hour test. We did a 22-hour test at Ricard, and then we put the car on a plane and flew it to what is it in Michigan? What's it called? Speedway. What is it? Test and Research. The General Motors test track.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
It's an 8 mile oval, and we went there for Thanksgiving, and it was bloody cold, and of course the only time of the year the track isn't used, so we had the track open and we put a chicane in before each banking, so we'd come into the banking through a chicane and sort of pull away in second gear and then accelerate all the way around for, like, I guess, you know, basically about half a third of the track to the next chicane, which was before the second banking. Slow, you know, brake like hell through the chicane and bank out and go around the bank and again. And we were obviously going over 200 miles an hour all the time, you know, everywhere we could. And we did that for several hours, and then they shipped the car back to France and we won Le Mans. Because at that point, I knew we could win, because it wasn't me, sadly, but that was the way things were.
Yeah.
But they were such a young, incredible, enthusiastic team, and it was just great. For me, it was such a contrast to where I'd been with before. And they were so sort of worked up about it because, you know, so much effort was going into it. It was with the other teams, it seemed like, well, Le Mans again, a big yawn, let's go back. But with them, it was, we're going to win this. And of course, we did the second year.
Wow. You know what I love? Moving from that program, to me, you go into two kind of fun years. One in 79 with the Mirage M10. I just look at that, although, again, it wasn't the result you wanted. I would have to believe that with teammates like Hobbs and Vern Schuppen, you must have had at least some very enjoyable dinner conversations or otherwise, because that seems like a winning combination among mates, even if the result wasn't what you wanted.
Yeah, I would love to have won with David, of course, and with Vern. I mean, I had the chance with Vern in the Porsche team, but which we didn't win them all. But actually, he never was my teammate at Le Mans. But no, with Hobbo, it would have been great to have pulled off a win with two Brits. It would have been great to have done it with three Brits, to be honest. But I guess you call him Australian and Brit as well.
under the flag.
You know, in that car. But of course, by then, I think we're running a Renault engine, weren't we?
Yeah, that was, definitely, it seemed like, the car looked lovely, I can tell you that, but...
It was the blue one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
DTC. It was hardly clutched in the car.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it was a frustrating time, that, because I didn't have much to do with the program, because I'd gone off to Renault, as you know. And I'm just wondering what the hell else I did in that. In many ways, the 70s was a crappy period in my life. And in 79, I was about to retire. In fact, I was right on the verge of retiring. But at the end of 79.
Wow.
But shit, Derek, you won Le Mans, you... basically world champion in the Alfa Romeos, because we won every, basically, more races than anybody else, and you won Le Mans that year, and I'd sort of been a 917, and God knows what else, I'd won the 1000Ks with the Mirage at Spa twice, and we had never won the ring, but not the ring, we'd won a lot of races, but that was, the sports car racing was in the doldrums in the late 70s, I mean, the Mirage basically still ran thanks to Harley Cluxton. And other people. But, I mean, literally, it was a struggle to get a drive. There was nothing out there. Did you really want to drive? And I was about to, I really was on the verge of quitting when I got a call from Steve O'Rourke saying, hey, you know, remember, because also in that period I drove the Jaguars for the work for the British Leyland team in the European Touring Car with Hobbs again and Schenken and Andy Rouse and John Fitzpatrick. I mean, it was we had a riot there, of course, but that's something else. But so you're going to say, well, that was a bloody good 10-year period. And when you look at what I drove as well, well, how can I be disappointed? But I drove, you know, I drove Formula 1, I drove Formula 2, I drove the 2-litre R-Bath, the Ostella R-Bath, I won the Tourist Trophy in the Alpina BMW. I had my, sort of was racing a little bit in America. You know what I mean? I mean, it's astonishing the variety. Somebody said to me, actually it was Damien Smith from Motorsport, said to me, this awards the other night, he said, I can't believe how the sort of the machinery that you drove in the 70s. Nobody else drove anything like that. But everybody, we had to, I drove 5,000, for God's sake, you know. I even drove that Can-Am car that's in mid-Ohio. And then I drove the Carling Black Label car at Elkhart Lake. And I drove the Sid Taylor at Michigan Speedway and came second to Schechter in 5,000. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Such a variety of, and 935, for God's sake. I mean, that was the period. I mean, it was amazing when you think about it.
And don't take this the wrong way, mate, but one of the things I find just incredible about your career is looking at the, you know, looking at three decades, almost, you know, unbroken at Le Mans, everything you've driven and everything else starting in the 60s as well, you're here and you're alive. And again, I don't say that in a negative way. It's just I think of all the opportunities, knowing about all the fatalities that existed at a time prior to track safety being even barely acceptable in the cars, to Damien's point, everything you drove at a time where danger was extremely present. Good Lord. The fact that we can have this conversation is absolutely brilliant. I think about all the IndyCar drivers.
I appreciate your thoughts, and don't worry, it's beginning to cross my mind a bit more than it ever did. And you might say, why now? Why did you sick bastard? Why did it take all this time? But because I guess suddenly, there's a few more, there's awards and similar coming through, or accolades, or whatever you want to call them, and you go, I wasn't that good. I didn't deserve it, but somehow, by persevering all those years, I mean, you know, even to the IMSIers. I mean, that wasn't even brought up the other night at the awards in London when I got my award. It was purely five Le Mans and you know, two World Sports Car Championships that I won. And, you know, when I think of what I did in America, too, and I put it from my mind about the danger side. You know, I just don't think about it. I mean, I got in that bloody McLaren at the coach the other day of Texas, and I never crossed my mind. I was in 195 down the bloody straight. It didn't cross my mind that it was dangerous. I have to admit, if you said to me, come back, we want you to go and do India or something, I'd probably think a bit more about it. But, I mean, I think more about the safety. But I've just been so bloody fortunate. Why is that? Because not many guys actually died through their own mistakes today. When you get down to it, it was a failure of the car that they generally broke.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, generally speaking, nearly everybody you went through that I can think of, I couldn't say, you know, that Joe Siffert, I wouldn't know about Joe Siffert's crash at Brands Hatch. Pedro was a bit of an animal. He wouldn't have surprised me if we always used to say he'll run into traffic and kill himself because he was just went anywhere he wanted. He'd just go flat out through the gaps which weren't there.
Wow.
I remember that. That's back in 71. So, you know, it might have been to do with that, which, of course, he died in 71, so I guess I wasn't with him very long. But we said that at the time, and later in the year he was dead. You can't drive like that. Anyway, I can't go into that now as such, but I was very fortunate. But I don't know whether I was just lucky. I mean, the cars were strong, weren't they? I drove some, what are the things I drove for? And the teams built bloody wonderful cars.
Well, speaking of...
The only car that I know really killed anybody was the Kramer car when it went off the road and that young Joe Gartner in at Le Mans. And, you know, I always said I'll never drive a Kramer, but, you know, I mean, 4 years later, I drive the thing and get pole position at... I got pole at Le Mans, didn't I?
Yeah.
In the Spider in 1994. and I swore I'd never drive for him. So I had to convince my daughter that I was only fooling around when I said that. That way down, and the car's much better now. But, you know, it's ridiculous. I was, because I wanted, I just love it. I didn't just want to win. I was, you know, I wanted to be in a bloody good car. And I think if you said to me, would you race next weekend, I probably would.
Oh, no doubt.
I don't mean at Le Mans. I don't think I could take that again physically. But I would, you know, I think I could still. Somebody said to me at Nürburgring last week at the 24, you know, you could jump in one of these, couldn't you? And I said, I think I could, yeah. You know, I'll be tired probably after a bit. But I'm not. I think the thing is, I mean, we're talking way off of the tangents a bit, but I think as long as you don't stop racing, you know, and sort of suddenly go, oh, I'm going to go to that race and watch it, and then, oh, I'm going to start again. I've never really stopped. I've stopped racing basically, but I'm always driving fast cars on tracks and test tracks. And, you know, I went with Bentley with the development of new products and that sort of thing. I'm always driving quickly as I can, but not really in weird and wonderful things that I can help it. I am aware of it, so I take those things into consideration.
Well, Mario told me he would absolutely jump at it tomorrow if either his son Michael launched a Le Mans program or they were offered. He said he would absolutely at, you know, 72, in his 70s, form a Mario, Michael, and Marco Andretti three-generation Le Mans program team. And
is that right? That's fantastic.
But it's the same type of passion, though.
I'm surprised because there's very few anybody out there that would do it that I'm aware of.
Well,
do you know what I mean? I don't know any other driver. I mean, he's been retired a while, although I know he drives these special cars now and again. You know,
the two-seaters and such. Car, yeah.
He keeps his hand in, and it's a bit like me getting in all the different things I get in. Yeah, I mean, we're all aware of the danger, but he's been upside down at various things and bounced down the track a few times. But I went upside down at Daytona, but bloody hell, I mean, that was, you know, the only one that I really had.
So I am, this to me is just a wonderful, wonderful addition to your CV. So we've spoken about the Ferrari 512, Porsche 917, the Gulfs, the Mirages, the Renaults, Porsche 924 Carrera GT.
They're rebuilding it here right now in England, that same one.
Tell me about that.
They found it somewhere in Germany, and they're rebuilding it. Literally, I'm going to drive it later in the year.
Oh, that is so brilliant. But I look at that and go, are you kidding? You know, it almost sounds...
I've got the road version of it sitting in my garage right now. One of the 25 they built. When that season was over, they said, would I stay on and drive... Actually, the late next year, I drove the 936 with Jackie, and we won.
Yeah.
The Jules car. And they asked me if I'd go back to and go to the factory, which I did, and we had a big Christmas party and the Porsche Cup thing, and then they said, would you drive for us next year, blah, blah, blah. And part of your contract was a car up to a certain value. So I ordered a 928S because I knew that they'd see through me and throw me out within a year. Anyway, just before I was due to get it, I chose everything, the color, interior, everything. And Professor Bock phoned me up like in November and said, Herr Bell, I'm afraid you will not be getting your 928S. We've got about 10 924 Carrera GTRs and S's sitting here. All the drivers are having one of those. So, I've got mine, and it's still electrifyingly fast to drive.
Wow.
I was out yesterday I was out in it. The Porsche uses it a lot because it's the only one really in England.
How brilliant.
Pardon?
I said, how brilliant.
Yeah, so I drive a lot, but they're actually picking it up to take it away. They use it at events all around the place to do Porsche Classic, particularly for the 40th anniversary of the 924 this year.
So how does that program, or how does that deal come together with Porsche? Because obviously that kicks off a wonderful long-term, almost career-defining relationship, and also with someone who you know is one of my absolute heroes, countryman Al Holbert, as well. Tell me about that, because it just, again, coming from 240 miles an hour in other cars at Le Mans, this was definitely a little bit different.
Yeah, it was. But of course, you realize that it came about because Peter Gregg had his accident.
Yeah.
Peter hit a farm car. I was due to drive the British car with Andy Ralph and Tony Tron. And Peter was driving with Al, as one would expect, an American car. And Peter had a crash and he had concussion, so they said, okay, you know, we don't really want you out there racing this soon after it, just in case. So they put me in the American car, which was most fortuitous, and they left the other two Brits in the British car. And, I mean, we qualified 35th, which is 10 places up the grid than the next one. And then gradually, and then we were running at 5th at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday in that little car with 320 or 330 horsepower. Because it was so economical, the bloody thing would like go 2 hours on a tank full or something.
Wow.
It'd have to stop. So, that, you know, it's a big thing at Le Mans, stopping for fuel. And, it, of course, in the rain, it wasn't too powerful. In the rain, it was, you know, that way. The weight distribution was fantastic.
Perfect.
And we just flew. I mean, literally flew. I mean, to run, I remember they put the board out P5, and it was 8 o'clock in the bloody morning.
Wow.
But unfortunately, then we lost the piston, which happened on that Morgan Strait. But my relationship with Al didn't start right then. I mean, I didn't really see much more of him. He stayed at the same hotel as me. And I guess we must have kept in touch, but I didn't drive for him for 2 more years, and or even 3. It was 70, it was 84 when I went to do the Miami Grand Prix, and he didn't have the car ready, the 962 Lombard car. So he said we've got to drive a 935. So I don't know what he did, a deal with John Fitzpatrick or something. Anyway, I drove a 935. And of course it rained up because I'd won it the year. Oh, hold on. No, shit, now that's talking bollocks. No, it isn't. Hold on. That's right. The year before, I drove, that's right, the year before, which was 84, I drove the John Fitt in his blue car. And it rained. I drove with Jochen Mass. The only time I drove with him, I think it was. And pictures, well, I don't know how well, we were in the top 3 or 4, it doesn't really matter, but. And we came in for tyres, and while we came in for tyres, they stopped the race. So they're like 8th or 10th or something. But that was it. And then the next year, of course, Al and I, so it was 75. Yeah, it was really my first year with Al. The first year of the 962, wasn't it? And it was the most amazing relationship, because to me, he's still... Yeah, I mean, I talked to him the other day, and I can't quite remember where, but it was in front of a, you know, crowded audience or something. And he, even in England, I talk about Al, and people obviously don't know really who he was. But I said, you know, they always say, who was the greatest driver? That's one thing. But who was the greatest person? You know, to me, Al was.
Wow.
And he was the best all-round person I ever met. I mean... You know, he was a wonderful engineer. He was a great organizer. I mean, he ran a car. He had a car business. His father ran, of course, but he had the car business. He had he was competitions director of Porsche USA. He ran an IndyCar team. He ran the sport car team, and he did all the development and testing. I mean, I did nothing. I mean, he did all the testing. And everybody thought, because I'd won, was winning a lot in Europe during that period. And then because of that, and then I was driving with Al and winning races there, they thought I was good, but he wasn't. But I, as a setup driver, I hadn't got a clue. And I remember thinking, I'm really going to learn something like that, because with Porsche themselves, of course, they all spoke in German. So whatever notes they took down, they wrote them in German. And then I'd try and look at the board in a break or something. And I go, I can't understand this crap. All I can understand were the lap times. But with Al, I thought, right, I'm really going to learn from this guy. And I remember every time he came in, he'd be sitting in the cockpit, and Kevin Durand would go out and start to debrief. But of course, they both had their headsets on. And I didn't put my headset on. Well, I don't think I could have connected to him if I wanted to. But So I never learned any more. I just drove the bloody car. And I guess I did okay. But you know, I didn't know much more about setting a car up, apart from my gut feeling of what a car should feel like, which, thank God, was quite good, that sort of belief. But I mean, he was just magnificent in every respect. I mean, the way he drove, the way he engineered the car, the way he ran a team. I mean, he didn't suffer fools. He had a sense of humor, a great sense of humor. But he didn't, you know, he was dead serious. And I remember he spent, you know, when we were at Le Mans together at that time, which is before we really got to know. I know he came and drove the 962, of course he did. Because he drove V1 with me twice, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And I mean, we won Daytona Le Mans in 2 years. Nobody else has ever done that. They don't even talk about it. The trouble is Daytona's lost its image a little bit, so of course people don't bring up the fact I've won it that much, because they think it's just a local race. But it was quite serious in those days. And he was just a magnificent person all round. I mean, you know, I know he was a born-again Christian, but that didn't alter the fact. For that reason, you trusted him very much. But I just thought he was fantastic. And he's, let's say, the best all-round person I ever met in racing.
Wow.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
So,
you know, who was the quickest? I really don't know. Probably Stefan Dalloff is the quickest, but then, bless him, he's not here to tell the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess it was Jackie Ickx was the greatest driver that I go with, because I think I tried to model myself on him, because I was always in high regard. He was always in my high regard.
Well, that's what I was curious about. What was it that worked between you and Jackie? Because there are, you know, plenty of folks that have won major races as teammates, but they, you know, you might not accuse them of either having similar viewpoints, driving styles, even personalities. The two of you had formed very successful relationship, won Le Mans 3 times. I mean, how... certainly it wasn't by coincidence. What was it that worked?
Three wins in the second in 4 starts.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. I hadn't really thought about the other thing coming from top. Yeah, that's what it was. Between he and I mean, as I said, he was at Ferrari, and he's like the number one at Ferrari when I was there. Everybody thought he was, I shouldn't use the word God because it's wrong, but you know, I mean, he was just the king of motor racing. He was this young guy. He was 3 years younger than me, but he was just a star. He was a total star, and he should have been world champion. In my opinion, he deserved to be. He should have been, and he was more than capable of being. But he's got to be in the right place, right time. But and I was always in awe of him, I suppose. So when he phoned up John Wire in '75 and said, "Mr. Wire, I'd like to drive with Derek and Lamar." And of course, John Wire leapt at the chance because Jackie Ickx was quite a catch, and having won it 3 times already at that point, I think. So, you know, for him to have it, it was fantastic, and for me to have him as a teammate, and I thought, oh God, he's going to come in and sort of, you know, throw his weight around. But he came in and he was totally accepted what he wanted. He said, whatever you want, you have it your way, and so on. And he said, you should start the race in this case, because it's your car. And then there's the round. I said, well, you're going to finish. And when he got towards the end, he told John Wire, I'd like Derek to finish. I said, it's his car, his project. I'd like him. He should be in the car. Because one didn't talk about the end of the race and you never bloody won it, did you? You know what I mean? So, you know, that was Jackie. And he was always most courteous. And he came up to me, 3 years ago at an event in Stuttgart. And he always very quiet. And he always says, he's always very serious. He doesn't say something unless he means it. And he came up and he took me to one side. He said, do you know something? He said, I've just got to thank you very much for all you did for my career.
Wow.
And he liked to say that. I mean, just amazing. He said, we were a great team, weren't we? And I looked at him, I wanted to cry. You know, it's amazing for any driver to say that. And of all the people, you can't believe it would be Jackie Ickx, because most people think of him as a hard, sort of conceited.
Well,
you know,
he's Belgian sort of, too. I mean, that's a pretty big strike to begin with.
Exactly. But I thought he was magnificent, and everybody, I was with him long enough, and he was with me. I think did he fly with the Alphas? Anyway, I was with him quite a lot at different times. And wherever he went, everybody was in awe of him. Everywhere he went, when he went to Porsche, you know, for the 936, he was there before me, obviously, because he'd won it a couple of times already in the late 70s. And as far as I was concerned, you know, I just tugged in behind him, and I was so lucky to get the drive. You know, they didn't have a forced driver, and I was driving to somebody else in an M1 BMW, Steve O'Rourke, I think, Floyd. And Steve said to me, who were you talking to just now? I said, oh, that was the engine man at Porsche. This was at Monza, beginning of that year, in 1981. And he said, well, you're deep in conversation. He was a great bloke. He was, you know, he was the Pink Floyd manager, so he knew all about business and delving and breathing and ducking. And I said, actually, Steve and I went out to dinner that night. But he was out here chatting about it. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, they wanted me to drive with them in one of their cars at Le Mans this year. He said, really? I said, yeah. What did you say? I said, no. I said, it's just a car. I'm driving with you. And he said, no. He said, I'll be so flattered if I thought that Porsche wanted one of my drivers.
Hmm.
He said, to drive for Porsche. So he then spoke to him. I then said, shit, I better find out whether they want me. And I lay in bed that night, and I didn't sleep all night. It was the night, actually, before the race at Monza with Steve. I lay in bed, and I'm just looking out like that at the ceiling, going, the only time I've had premonition in my life, seriously and honestly, and I looked up, and my eyes shut, and I kept dreaming that I was going to win them all. I thought, and I didn't know the car, anything about it. I just knew it was Porsche. And remember, I'd only driven the 917 before, a few 935s, but they weren't for the factory. And I just knew we were going to win. I'd never had premonition in my life. And we went Monte. It all worked out. I phoned up Manfred Janka the next day and said, Manfred, I understand that you're going to Le Mans this year. He said, yes. He said, I said, well, I could be available, but I didn't want to shoot myself in the foot and end up with guys to drive.
Yeah.
Derek, that is wonderful. That is wonderful. Now, his very words were, now I have the best two drivers in the world. You will drive with Jackie.
Wow.
Whoa. That was amazing. I mean, I thought I'd drive the second or third car, or whatever they had. Yeah. I mean, I was the last driver to join.
How brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, the stories go on, Marshall. I could talk for days.
No. What I wanted to know, and... pardon me if we're venturing a little bit into stereotypes here, but you drive for the factory Ferrari team at Le Mans, you drive for the factory Renault team at Le Mans, you drive for the factory Porsche team at Le Mans, between Italy, France, and Germany. I think you have covered every spectrum of personality type, or at least a stereotypical personality type. What do you recall from the culture differences, or what stood out culturally between those three that either makes you laugh or makes you appreciate the way they did things?
I think the difference was my initial impressions were there were three totally different, as you said. But to drive for Ferrari, they cried if you won and they cried if you didn't. So that was that done with. And then, of course, you went to Porsche, and they just expected to win because they did it as a business. They're passionate. But Porsche were a racing company, whether they're building road cars or not. They're a racing company. So are Ferrari, one has to admit. But Porsche particularly, because of the way they've been in everything over the years, including the Paris-Dakar and that sort of thing. And I think every car they build, they look at is how can we make this into a successful race car.
Mm.
And then, of course, you had the third one, which was Renault. And it was a group of young graduates, if you like, from university that were going to go and race a car in a class of which they'd never had anything to do with before. And they were starting from scratch. And they were going to have the fastest rise to fame by running in 2 liter sports cars, Le Mans sports cars, and then Formula One. And, they did pretty well in all that. But they did it in a lot fewer years than anybody else did it. I mean, I guess that's a simple thing. I mean, is that a good enough explanation?
Well, of course. The portion of your career that I think, I don't know, this is just absolutely, it's peerless. Your stretch from 1981 to 1988 at Le Mans, I don't know if it will ever be duplicated, replicated, or even come close. From 81 to 88, you win, finish second, finish third, win, and finish second. All with our friends at Porsche, all with either Ix, my favorite, everyone's favorite yodeler, Mr. Stuck, Klaus Ludwig, and Al Holbert. I know it's maybe a bit of a general question about a specific time period, but what do you recall from that time? Because, good Lord, mate, we could not get you off the podium. I mean, that was, again, I have to imagine a dream period with fantastic drivers.
Yeah, it was funny you should say that. Yeah, I was flying over on a flight from America after Lime Rock. Because Lime Rock used to be on the Monday, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then we had to be at Le Mans on the Tuesday. So we'd fly out on that Monday night, we'd all dash off to LaGuardia or something to get the flight to London or to Paris. And I remember sitting with Bob Barsha. And I didn't, you know, I know Americans love statistics because I didn't even know the figures you just mentioned. I know that they're there because I must have seen them over the years. But, and, you know, Bob Barsha said to me, he said, do you realize, in the last 11 times you've done Le Mans, and he went, you haven't finished outside the top four or something like that. It was something almost like that.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, shit, Bob, I didn't know that. You know, Brits don't worry too much about, at least I didn't, statistics. I mean, I still don't know how many races I did, or even how many I won. I know I won something like 37 for the factory over my World Championship and American Championship time, because Professor Bott said to me, and this was going back a bit, because bless him, he's been dead for 20 years, and he said, do you realize that you have won more races in the history of sports car racing in this period than any other driver ever? And I went, oh, I didn't know that.
Wow.
But it was something quite new. You said you've won 37 races in that period. No other Porsche driver's ever done that. They still haven't today, actually, as far as I'm aware. Not at the top level, not at, you know, LMP1 level or Group C level. Because when you win, nothing has gone wrong. So you've just driven flat out as much as you can. You know, I mean, people said we didn't drive flat. We did. We drove flat bollocks out, but we didn't have the power. We had it reduced, you know, we had less mixture, less boost. But we still drove like lunatics through the corners. But we didn't have to stress the car because we were shifting gear by hand all the time and the clutch. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
I drove that McLaren. They had bloody air conditioning in the helmet, which was glorious. And I, you know, it was a sequential gearbox. I mean, shit, you know, it was just lovely. But, I mean, you think about it. We had to, you know, the bloody thing, those wonderful cars didn't have power steering. And we had, a regular six-speed or five-speed gearbox that we had to shift every damn gear, and we didn't really want to miss more than one gear out as we came through. And we hadn't, you know, and you sat there in all that heat and no air conditioning. Anyway, I'm not bitching. Generally speaking, it's very difficult to bring one race out that we won that was greater win than any others, because it was probably a little better in a Daytona, if for example, than it was at Le Mans, because when the car ran perfectly, you just ran well. I mean, I know we were discussing it at this function the other night because somebody remembers something, and I didn't win that. You know, we came second behind in 80. I came second in 88, didn't I? You got that
correct. Second in 88 with Stoke and Ludwig.
I got 87, 81 to 88. Because we came second to the Jag, and we should have won that by miles. It's only because Ludwig ran out of petrol. See, yeah. I can remember those when we didn't win because of the dramas that went on. But Ludwig ran us out of petrol. And he had to come back on the starter motor. And at one stage, we were seven laps ahead. And then we ran out of gas. And then they had to change, I think it was a fuel pump at another point.
Mm-hmm.
And then we still caught up a number. We still were only three laps behind at the end, having been seven laps behind at one stage. So those sort of races, I can remember. I can remember, you know, I can remember the 83 one when we were going for our hat-trick, Jackie and I. And we had so many. Every time we got in the lead, something happened, and we dropped back. And I remember I got the lap record twice in the last hour, driving without any brakes. And we still finished. We finished second behind Hurley and an Owl, if you remember. But that's beside the point. But those races, I remember the details. But I can remember a bit of the Mirage victory, because that was my first, and it was in a different sort of car. I know we had a broken chassis. But the 962s, I know we won, yeah, And you're not really asking me that, but I can remember us winning one particular year when, and this thing, hold on, which year it was. Anyway, I know that we had a Jochen's car and the third plate. Nearly all the Porsches fell out except for us. And it was just Stuttgart now.
Hmm.
It must be 86 or 87.
Yeah.
If one of those two you've got down there. And Al, and we, Stuckey did the start. In fact, it was in the car that I was in. No, it's the one we won. I was in one 2 days ago. I was in the car that I finished second with in 88, the Dunlop car. I was driving it up the hill here at the RAC Club two nights ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the same slicks that it was on in 1988.
Oh, those must have been lovely.
And it was raining the other night, too. What is a nightmare? It's just ridiculous thing to do something. Anyway, and I remember that all the cars went off like scaldy cats, and we all knew that Le Mans is not won on the first lap, even the first hour. We all know that, should know it by now. And thank God Stuckey and Al and I had won it the year before, so, and we won, you know, Al and I had won a couple of Daytonas or three at this point, so we knew we were going to be quite cool about this. And the others all blind off. Everybody wants to lead the first hour or lead the first lap. And there'd been a bit of kerfuffle with the fuel mixture, or with the fuel supply to the track. And the outcome was that we didn't turn our boost up, which we never did unless told to. We never towed the mixture up. And everybody else obviously did, and we were lying about 7th or 5th or 6th at the end of the first lap. It doesn't matter. And all the guys in front all fell out because they turned up their engines and it leaned them off too much without realising the fuel wasn't up to it.
Jeez.
And they all blew up.
Jeez.
Or had problems or went on to, you know, 5 cylinders or whatever it was. So that was, anyway, that was the only one that I remember, and we won that race, but I know no more than that.
You know,
I'm sorry about that.
No, good Lord. I mean, one of the things I'd love to learn about is I look back at, I guess maybe this is more 82, 83, 85, and the 956 and 962, but two driver rotation, closed cockpit, no air conditioning. What was driver fitness? What were your driver fitness standards like back then, and how exhausting was, you know, not having four driver rotation and being able to go off and sleep for hours on end? Seems like that might have been a bit grueling.
Yeah, you would think it would be, but we didn't know any different, did we, Marshall?
Hmm.
You know, that was what it was. We're only just fit enough to finish 24 hours, but I can tell you that. There wasn't much left anymore. You know, it was a real struggle to get to the end, but you're such a... Thank God I was always in a great car, and therefore I had a reason to drive my heart out without really having any heart left, you know. The only thing I had left, I mean, was probably heart. And I guess it was the same for all of us. And, you know, it was incredibly hard with two drivers. But, I mean, remember, I'd grown up watching Stirling Moss do all his races when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, or 15, 16, 17, whatever it was. Just two drivers in a car. I mean, that's what it was. So, naturally, that's what you had, wasn't it? Two drivers, you didn't have more. Why should you have more? So, I never crossed my mind, because I'm a bit dense as well. So, my first 13 years at Le Mans, I drove with two drivers.
Wow.
But not many. But the fact was, I remember Jackie saying to me, in 1973, he said, I think it's time we had an extra driver. And because it's typical Jackie to think like that. See, I'd never used my brain for that degree and think, you know, if we had a third driver, we would have to do so much. But I remember Jackie writing to me. He used to write letters. It was unbelievable. And because we didn't have the internet then. And he said, I think, well, what do you think? He always passed it by me, and he was always very good like that. Well, I don't know what things he did without telling me, but nevertheless, the things he did tell me. And he said, I think it's time we have a third driver. Who do you think we should have? Or what do you think? And who should we have? I remember thinking about it for about 5 minutes, anyway. And I thought about it a bit longer, probably, but I was already decided. And I said, there's nobody out there that's... I didn't say good enough, but I implied that. I don't know... The only person that crossed my mind was Stuckey. And he's the only place that I can think of in sports car racing that would have been... You know, with the foot of the bill. And And so, anyway, we didn't have anybody that year. And that was the year that we finished second, by 26 seconds after everything kept failing. And I got out and had intravenous in both arms. You know, I mean, that was in such a disastrous state.
Good Lord.
Fitness was probably what you started the conversation. How did you do it? And all I know is we could just about do it. But I worked out. I suppose I should have been, I could have been fitter. But remember, we were racing every 2 weeks anyway, and I was still doing dashing across the Atlantic, and I was just about to actually at that stage, wasn't I, to do my races with Al. And, you know, to me, it was just a matter of I was quick enough to win races, or, fit enough to win races, I think. I can't think there's any other reason to get fitter than that.
Yeah.
Because I certainly never let the side down. I never sort of went slower at any one point. The trouble was, in those races in those days, that, you know, they would, rather like the 83 race, you'd have to sort of really pull it out of the bag and really sort of put every effort into it towards the end because you had a chance to do better. The races that we won, we were already up front. Sure, we were driving, you know, to the limit. We were driving within our, you know, the car's limits, but not overdriving it, not stuck in the gearbox. I mean, the number of people that had gearbox problems, that sort of thing. And we didn't hit anything. And that's the other thing. I don't remember ever hitting anything in the 962 in Le Mans. I really don't. In fact, I went into the stand once, 1 year when I drove for a little French team, not Renault, another one. And I sort of slid off when I went out on new tyres and forgot. On the chicanes, on one of the chicanes, and went through this kitty litter and had to come in and have it brushed out. But I didn't stop to cause me any loss of time.
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry.
No, that's the amazing thing looking at your Le Mans CV, Derek, is that if it wasn't some sort of car failure or vehicle failure, you're essentially in the top 10, if not deep inside the top 10. I mean, that's the part that I think is an eternal lesson for endurance drivers. Anyone that is looking to do long races, barring a vehicle failure, and this is mostly earlier in your career when, you know, whether it was a gearbox or an engine, when those things tended to break and before the state of automotive reliability heightened in general, if the car wasn't breaking, I'm just looking here quickly, whenever you finished, every single one of your finishes at Le Mans was inside the top 7. I mean, that's phenomenal. Yeah, that is phenomenal. Every single finish, I'm just counting, I realize I probably should have prepared all this in advance, but I'm just looking here, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 of your 19 finishes at Le Mans, all 19 were inside the top 7.
18, is that right?
Yeah.
Bloody hell. Because you see, we could have so easily won with the McLaren, you see.
Yep.
You know, I mean, Justin and I and Andy Wallace, I mean, we were just bloody unlucky that we just couldn't hold on to the lead after all those hours. But, good God, that's amazing, isn't it?
Stuck was one of my father's absolute favorite drivers, and as my dad would say, you could always tell which one was Stuck's car because it had more bugs on the side of it than on the windshield. I mean, his car control was legendary. Obviously, in a high downforce prototype, you're not exactly drifting the thing, but did you get a chance to see Hans' car control or have an appreciation for it?
Well, I drove, the manufacturer didn't mention because I drove for the factory BMW team. But that doesn't matter right now. But I drove for the year of 73 or 74 with the BMW team. And that was Stuck and Ronnie Peterson and Brian Redman.
Yeah.
And but unfortunately, it was the year of the 93 was the year of the fuel crisis in Aden, or the sewage crisis, something in that area. And BMW felt they couldn't be spending money wasting on fuel while the rest of the world was trying to conserve it. So we only did two or three races. And of course we went off and doing our training at Wintersport, our winter training with the team. And And then we came back from that, and we went to Paul Ricard testing. And remember, I had won, I'm not saying you don't remember, but I won the GT, as I think I mentioned, with Harold Urkel at Silverstone, which was a European championship, a bit like the Deutsche Meisterschaft thing, for, you know, big cars. They
were, sure.
Yeah, kind of horsepower GT. Well, no road cars. But it was fantastic, and Niki Lauda drove it, and Hans Stuck drove it, and I mean, everybody drove in it. Ludwig, I mean, it was a forerunner, really, of, I guess, of like, 935, 934 type cars, anyway. And we won, and so from that, I'm trying to give his name, Jochen Nierpasch approached me and said, would I join the factory team? Because I got pole position at the Rain, which was ridiculous, ahead of all these stars. And then I went out and won the race with Harold Urkel, but I did get pole. So that doesn't matter right now. But from that, obviously, BMW had to take note and sort of want me on board, so I was due to join them. And I'll never forget, I mean, the times we had with the training side of it, and it was highly amusing with Stucky out there on the snow and all the rest of it, because he was so bloody tall and gangly. But then we went to test at Paul Ricard, and I think it was just me and Stucky for some reason, and I was going around and, of course, driving tidily the way sports car races do. I've never liked Paul Ricard, incidentally, so that was probably the only track probably in the world I didn't really like that much. I had nothing against it except I couldn't go quickly, which meant I didn't like it. And although I did win a race there with Jackie in the Mirage, I think, but nevertheless, I didn't like it that much. And we went to Paul Ricard, and it was and did some testing. And I remember I came in, and Jochen Nierpasch said, go out there, Derek, onto so-and-so corner and watch Hans. So I said, all right, you know, why not? So I went around the outside of the track, found the corner, and I watched him. And he just came through on four opposite lot. I was absolutely staggered. I went, oh, shit, I can see now what you mean. Yeah, I can see why I'm not getting on that well. I just wasn't prepared to sort of go sideways so much, because obviously in the sort of stuff I was used to going in, I know it was early 70s, but I mean, you didn't drive, I mean, but he's like it in single seaters as well, you see. That was the point. And of course, what happens is people like him, they go and set the car up to suit that style of driving.
Sure.
Now, I watched Jackie Ickx in that car, or Brian Redman in that car, or Ronnie Peterson, he wouldn't have been the sideways. But Stuckey got it that sideways, and it was so exciting that people went to watch it. And I don't think it was any quicker. It was quicker than me, because I didn't realize just how hard you had to drive. But generally speaking, in the races, I don't think it was really any quicker than Ronnie, or any quicker than Brian, or whoever else is in the team. It's just that he was so flamboyant with it.
Wow.
It's not really a very good story, but that's the only one I really got. But it certainly opened my eyes as to how I had to drive it.
No, it's brilliant. The other other question, which I would imagine, you know, probably one of the dumber and more obvious questions I've ever asked, but the ability to race at Le Mans with your son, ability to do that. I love the livery on the car as well, the ADA 962. Yeah. Tell me about that.
There's one sitting 12 inches from my head right here now. The car, the number 29.
What was that like? I mean, generationally, proud father, your son obviously had proven himself as a talent.
I mean, the most memorable race was obviously a leading Le Mans for 16 hours, or whatever it was, maybe 15 and a half, but actually, now I figure 16. And then finishing up in third place and being on the winner's rostrum at Le Mans with your son on Father's Day. And that was it, really. It was really, 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 very special. But, I mean, it wasn't, again, I can remember almost every damn lap of it, because obviously my son was in the car, who knew the car better than me, because he'd driven it already two or three races that year. He did the whole season in it. I just came in after I'd retired, supposedly, in 74, and said, for goodness sake, Dad, you're going to have to come and share the car with us. So I did. And I'm so glad I did, obviously, because, you know, it's given me a great time with McLaren. And the car is sort of almost part of folklore, much more than the car that won it, strangely enough. And that's why I drove the P1 GTR the other day in Austin, because it's in the Harrods colours, basically.
Beautiful.
And I'm going to do some more with it later in the year. But, I mean, it came out of the blue because those two were driving, Andy and he were driving together. And I didn't really know even who they were going to be with at Le Mans. But as far as I knew, it was all organized. About 4 weeks before, they phoned and said, come on, Dad, you're going to have to do Le Mans with us. And the funny thing was, because I wasn't ready for it. Le Mans is one of those races that I'd prepare myself on January the 1st, I mean, and start to prepare myself for the June race, because I believed in my own mind it seemed to take me that long to get in perfect physical way and also mental approach. And I didn't have a mental block about had to read that, go to bed at this point. I mean, but it just was a build-up for that incredible race. So out of blue, 3 weeks before, so I'm asked to do the race with them, and I knew I wasn't ready. I wasn't prepared. I was physically good. I was in good shape, but I hadn't had time, and it really bothered me that I wasn't in good enough shape. Anyway, I thought, well, we're going to be out by 10 o'clock at night anyway, because this car has this something in the transmission, which I'm not going to go into now, but there was something somewhere that was not reliable, and the car that Alfie won the race had the components that we didn't have. And we knew it beforehand, but nobody's prepared to spend 100,000 quid for buying this special modification just for one race. They were all very pissed off about it. So I think when we led the race all that time, everybody was pretty excited. But the reason we led for so long from 10 o'clock at night was because it pissed the rain. And of course, it didn't stress the transmission, and that was fine, if you follow what I mean. So that was it. Really, and of course we just cruised on and on and on. I mean, if I slid off wide on a corner in the rain, then so would JJ Aletta. Excuse me, that's how it was through the whole race. I mean, what one did, the other one seemed to do, and we weren't within view of each other. I mean, we never got within, I don't think, 20 seconds. But I remember I went out at, well, at A in the night. I've done quite a long stint. Remember, it was a long night because it was raining the whole time, so a lot of dark.
Sure.
I liked the rain, but I was always fairly good in the rain. And, in fact, never really, that I recollect, actually, I went off the road in the rain, not enough to damage a car anyway. And, in the night, I remember I came in thinking, well, I've got 3 or 4 hours off now, because those two guys, Andy and Sebastian, do. And I was ready for sleep. Anyway, so I sort of had a shower or whatever we did, and had a massage, was eating something, and the next thing is Sebastian walks into the motorhome. And I went, what the hell are you doing here after 40 minutes? And he said, Dad, his eyes looked like poached eggs. He said, they were so big and round. He said, I have never been so frightened in my life. He said, I had a moment out there at one section after an hour, which I could understand, because you can't see anything. And you just aim the car into the dark and hope you're going to get the apex about 140 miles or more an hour.
Jesus.
And before you get to push curves with a double left-hander, and it drops away. And I think he spun there. Anyway, he shit himself, basically.
Wow.
And that was it. So he continued his stint, but his lap times just plummeted down, you know, to being bad. Because he couldn't have confidence, he lost it all. So they quite wisely gave Price yoinked him out, and when he stopped, he said, "You better get out." And they then got Andy in. So I thought, "Well, excuse me, the reason I'm yawning is the bloody door's open. It's bloody cold. It's because it's 6:30. It suddenly got cold then." And so anyway, Andy gets in. I think, "Well, I've still got 2 hours." I tell him. And the next thing, I go to relax and I just sort of lay down. I never ever slept at the mall, but I was lying down. And the next thing is, there's a knock on the door, and they say, Derek. I said, what's up? They said, you've got to get in the car. I said, look to my watch. I said, but I thought it was another. And they said, Andy's can't drive anymore. I said, what do you mean? They said, he cannot concentrate anymore. I went, bloody hell.
Wow.
That was me at 55, and they're a bloody 35. And I thought, what the hell is this? That not his third Sebastian, about 27. Andy was about 40. And what is wrong here? So anyway, I went and jumped in the car and had, obviously, I can't remember much about the drive, but I guess I did my 2 hours. And then we were still leading the whole time. And then I think that one of the highlights, if there was a highlight of that race apart from finishing third, was the fact that then the next morning, I get in the car to take over Justin by now being put back in, because it was dry, you know, it wasn't raining. I mean, you could see too, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. And I got in the car And as I went out, I said, how are we doing? And they said, well, I knew roughly that how we're going to do it, you know, during right this second. And they said, once you get going for your lap, you'll be 20. You're going to be still be ahead. So I thought, shit, you know, it's daylight. Everybody's watching. Derek Bell, age 55, 56, whatever it was, 54, maybe. There's Derek Bell's going out, and there's J.J. Letcher or whoever with the other young the young Frenchman. They're right behind them. Both of them are winners before. And I thought, oh, Christ, this guy, I'm just going to get blown away, aren't I? And I just drove without looking. I didn't really look in the mirror. And the first lap round, I was 27 seconds or 26 seconds in the lead. And by the end of my hour, I was 33 seconds in the lead. So I pulled out sort of half a second a lap, and because we just did one stint at that point. And I was so tickled because I thought the whole world was going to see this old fart overtaken by the young fart, and I actually pulled away. So it was pretty special.
Okay.
That, to me, was, you know, what I needed mentally, you know, to sort of give me the confidence that maybe at 55 I wasn't over the hill.
That's so brilliant. Well, the last question I had for you is one we touched on in Monterey last year, and that was you're, I think, rightfully proclaiming, hey, Porsche, I've driven just about every motor racing vehicle you've ever produced. You have this new Le Mans winner, the 919 Hybrid. How about we complete the cycle here? You had anyone from Germany reach out and extend an invitation? And if not, what do we need to do to make that happen?
No, we have literally, but I get on very well with Frank Stefan Wallister, who's the head of Porsche Competitions. And I actually, at last year at the Rennsport, I had a chance to drive three of the more classic cars, Porsche cars, but obviously that, not the 919. And I drove the RS, you know, what's it called? What's it called? The 2000 RS, is it? Anyway, the Penske car. So I drove the Penske, you know, the car that they ran 2 or 3 years ago.
The RS Spider?
RS Spider, thank you. I knew an RS in it somewhere. And I that was wonderful, that it was a real race car, and it was fantastic. And then after that, I ended up being shown around. I think it was by a young driver. I mean, one of the drivers. I think it wasn't Nick Tandy. It was a kid. It was another young man, and he showed me around. And Mark Webber was there. Anyway, he said, "Come on, you got to get it." I was in my overall, so I got in the 919. And I sat in it, and I have to admit, it was amazing to sit in it. And of course, then somebody says, "Well, you better get to drive it." And then Mark and I were talking about it, and he said, "You know, you just got to drive it. You just need it. You with 1,000 horsepower, and just drive it. You know, you won't want to change around worrying about fuel consumption." And that's the whole thing. As a racing driver, give him a car, and he'll go and drive it quickly. It's all who wants all the technical shit that goes with it. You've got to keep pressing buttons, and look at even Rosberg the other day, you know, that incident probably caused by him, because he was looking down trying to press the right fucking button.
Yeah.
180 miles an hour in a Formula One car or at 919, it must be pretty idiot. Easy to do. No, but so to answer your question, yes, one day I've got to, because I've driven everything else they've ever built, like, you know, every other car I've driven. Particularly now I drove the RS Spider. You know, I said there's nothing I haven't, to be honest. I drove the LMP. Oh no, what was it called? What was that car called? GT1?
The GT198.
99 car. Yeah, I drove one of those. I've driven them up the hill. And that's something, you know, I could drive anything. It's not that difficult. I would be intrigued, because obviously I've been driving the Bentley over the last few years, although not for the last two, but driving the Bentley Le Mans car a lot. So I got used to it. I find it claustrophobic in those cockpits. But as long as I can get in and out, as long as I can get out, right, you know, as long as I can press the button, the door goes up, I'm okay to get out. But it's like, you know what I mean? I haven't had to get out, but I've got this claustrophobic thing, and they sent me up the hill at Goodwood, and the door strap wasn't connected. And I said, you know, I can't get out. And they said, don't worry, you won't have to. somebody will open it for you at the top. I said, what happens if a tire, bloke in front of me spins, I come up, hit his oil, and I'm up against the tire wall, and I can't get out. And I look at all that side of things as long as I know I can get out easily, I'll drive anything. So to answer your question, yes, please, when are you going to do it?
Amen. Well, I'll talk to good old Frank when I get to Le Mans, and I'll sit on him if I have to. But we need to make this happen, mate.
Yeah, I think maybe Le Mans is a good time. You know, certainly if they won, I think they will. Somebody said, you know, it'd be interesting to see how Porsche get on this year. And I'm going, and my literal words were replied, and I said, all they have to do is polish the wheels and do it all again because they know how to win.
And that was the fiery Derek Bell, 74 years old, made his last Le Mans start 20 years ago in 1996, and in typical Derek fashion, where did he finish? Of course, he finished fifth. So, finishing fifth in his mid-50s, I'm fairly confident he would be a valuable addition to any GTE AM program. Even if he kept his hours to a minimum, I still think Derek would bring some magic to the cockpit. So, thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallpruitt.com.